Before we jump into the show, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about an exciting upcoming event. You may remember that I launched a live speaker series in March called Talking San Diego. You can get all the info for that at talkingsandiego.net. But with the success of our first event with Congressman Jamie Raskin, we are keeping it rolling. On May 15th at 7 p.m. at University of San Diego's Shiley Theater, I'll be in a conversation with MSNBC host and former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about her new book, Say More, and other parts of her varied and exciting professional and personal life. I can't wait to bring Jen to the San Diego stage, and I really hope to see some Talking Feds fans there. To purchase tickets and for more information, plus an opportunity to get a signed copy of Jen's new book, click the link in the episode description. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. The Supreme Court heard argument last week on Donald Trump's immunity appeal. We knew it would be significant, but because I was in New York attending the first ever criminal trial of a former president, we opted to do a special episode with other eyewitness observers of the trial. The Supreme Court argument turned out to be even more significant than had been projected, alas. And it feels like we wouldn't be talking feds if we didn't also do a special episode about the argument, which has the earmarks of being its own moment in history, and not a happy one. Moreover, in the wake of the argument, there's a sharp divide among commentators, many of whom are typically in agreement about where the court is going, when it will get there, and whether it will leave any opening for the charges against Trump to proceed in some truncated form before the election. So we wanted to offer up our own Talking Feds take on what has become a robust debate. To try to suss out whether the argument effectively put the brakes on any immunity trial this year, as well as whether the court's opinion is likely to wreak havoc on presidential accountability for criminal conduct, we welcome a terrific trio of Supreme Court experts, all returning guests to Talking Feds. And they are Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, co-host of the popular and excellent podcast, The Slate Political Gabfest, and a lecturer and Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks very much for joining.
Hey, glad to be here with all of you.
Leah Littman, it's been a while, is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Law, the co-host of Crooked Media's Gold Standard Strict Scrutiny podcast, and the co-founder of Women Also Know Law, a media and academic tool to promote women and non-binary academics, and a fellow of the American Law Institute. Leah, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Stern, a senior writer covering courts and the law for Slate. He's covered the U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts, and state and local courts for over 10 years. He's the author of the book American Justice 2019, The Roberts Court Arrives. And speaking of which, it is very much with us. I'm struck by the diversity of opinion among commentators in the wake of the argument on Thursday. But let's start with a few points that seem clear. Let me at least serve them up to you to see if there's any disagreement here. So we have thought of it as axiomatic. I have thought of it as axiomatic that the court is not going to hold that Trump has immunity for all the acts in the indictment. Let me just stop there. Thus say we all, three nods of the head here.
It has to be so because his attorney, Sauer, at arguments conceded that there was private conduct alleged in the indictment. Whether he meant to do that is unclear to me, but he did it. So I think you're right.
And also a point of common agreement is the court, you know, sort of surprised us again. Mark was in the courtroom, but there was a lot of hope that maybe the court would just decide the case the way the D.C. Circuit had done and leave potentially naughty questions of presidential immunity for another day. ain't going to happen. Do we all agree they're going to, the court as a whole, maybe in some splintered fashion, will be looking beyond the case, and there's going to be a case for the ages, to quote Gorsuch, you know, a concern about how this plays in the future. Thus say we all.
Yes. So I'm not sure that any of the people on this podcast were particularly surprised that that seemed like it was going to be how it was going to play out after the argument. But I think what became clear is that they were going to use this case to basically come up with as many possible theories that they could use this case to explore in order to buy more time in the case, perhaps, and then speculate about possible future cases that might actually present difficult factual circumstances under any of these possible legal theories and questions that they came up with, and that, like, Trump's attorney was not actually pressing throughout the litigation, including in this very case. And then they were like, wow, we just developed 45 hypothetical situations involving legal questions that aren't actually part of this case that might be pretty tricky. So let's potentially opine on those.
And I think the three of us kind of thought when we saw the question presented, they were going in some direction like that. The whether and if so when there's immunity seemed to be that they were going to be roving away from the four corners.
I always struggle with, like, the difference between surprise and shock, and I sort of want to hold on to shock. So I am shocked. And I also want you all to explain this to me. Like, I don't understand this. I mean, I understand that to justify taking the case and taking so long, then you turn it into the case of the ages. But I don't understand, just from the basic set of presumptions about how you deal with a case like this, why they have gone off into the land of all the hypotheticals you were saying, Leah. And I also don't understand how, once Trump's lawyer conceded there was some private conduct, why the court can't just say there's some private conduct, like, go figure out the scope of that at trial, not at some whole separate evidentiary proceeding. And maybe the answer is, like, sure, they could do that. They're just not going to do that because they want to slow everything down more. But I felt like things that had seemed clear suddenly seemed totally up for grabs. And the farther I get from the argument, the more actually sort of gobsmacked I am about all of that.
I got to say, I agree. On Thursday, as little details were coming out, almost like ticker tape in the olden days, I did feel like Charlie Brown and Lucy again, and like, what the hell was I? And here they go. They've done it again to us. Why? I feel shocked. Should I feel shocked? You were in the courtroom and absorbing it in real time. What? Give us your sense of, from someone who knew the case, to sort of watch it transpire in real time. Was it gobsmacking?
Well, it wasn't at first. At first, it went as expected, right? The liberals posed their hypotheticals about assassinating a rival, about the military staging a coup that we all expected. He gave terrible answers, as we expected. Chief Justice Roberts asked a pretty good question about how you sort of slice out official conduct when a president commits a crime, that I thought was sort of pointing toward him saying, come on, guys, we all know we can sort of make this work and keep the trial moving. It felt good even through Justice Barrett's questions, where she did what I mentioned earlier. She was going through the list of actions in the indictment and saying, is this private? Is this private? And Sauer was saying, yes, it is. And so by that point, I thought, all right, there's like five votes to just say, like, this trial can move forward, whatever the line is between official conduct and private conduct. Either we'll sort of announce it now and this indictment can remain, or we'll say that there's no, like, true official conduct alleged here that bothers us or something. And then, of course, Dreeben got up there and the entire thing turned, like, rapidly and frighteningly. And the justices started saying things, where I did a podcast with Pam Carlin last week, and she said there were multiple moments where she was just so shocked and thought, did that really just come out of a Supreme Court justice's mouth? Especially when Justice Alito was saying, you know, don't you think that allowing accountability for a former president is going to actually encourage future presidents to crime their way into an unearned second term? And so we really, to avoid criminal precedents, have to let this one off the hook. And this was sort of a quick moment, and it didn't get a lot of play and coverage, but it was actually a kind of a jaw on the floor moment for me, because Brett Kavanaugh was grilling Dreeben, and he said, quote, I'm not focused on the here and now of this.
Yes. It's like, holy shit.
I'm very concerned about the future. So, I mean, there's so much we could say about that. I think it just illustrates the points that Leah and Emily made a moment ago. But more broadly than that, it actually is sort of like maybe not a legitimate way of doing constitutional law. And this is a point that actually Justice Scalia made in his Windsor dissent that I think was like his only really good point in that dissent, where he said the court is not even purporting to decide a true case or controversy. It is simply pronouncing a grand constitutional idea and telling everyone who hears it, you must now adhere to this idea. Now, whether that was an accurate description of what the court did there, I'm not so sure. But that is exactly what Kavanaugh wants to do here. He doesn't even care about the Article 3 case or controversy before him. He doesn't care about the facts. He doesn't care about Trump. He doesn't care about this indictment. According to him, this is all about foreseeing future cases down the road and acting as the nation's chief policymaker in terms of how the Justice Department can punish a former president who is alleged to commit crimes. That is not a role for a judge. I thought until like Thursday, that was sort of common ground across the political spectrum. Now it seems that at least when Trump is involved and his liberty is at stake, Kavanaugh and his ilk are ready to totally pivot toward this idea of the Supreme Court as openly just policy making its way through helping Republicans not face consequences.
Can I just say two things to underscore a few points that Mark made that I think are worth rehashing and like repeating because they are just so wild? One is, I want to make sure everyone understands the hypothetical Justice Alito throughout, which is, isn't it true, according to Sam Alito, that in a world without immunity, more presidents would refuse to leave office and attempt to interfere with the peaceful transition of power because they would be worried about prosecution? This seems to imagine that after November of 2020, if people told Donald Trump, don't worry, Donald, you're not going to face any criminal liability for contesting the results of a valid election or refusing to leave office, then he wouldn't have done anything he is alleged to have done between November and January 2021. This is unhinged. Like, no one could possibly think that. And of course, it ignores the fact that this very case, right, presents a former president who was refusing to leave office and alleged to have engaged in an attempted insurrection. And that is, again, like the fantasy frame that many of them viewed this case with. And I think there are oftentimes like hard questions in Supreme Court cases about whether the justices should go big or go small. That is, whether they should use a case to announce a rule, you know, that governs a few similar cases or governs like a large number of cases. But one of the pieces of common ground that, again, I thought people shared is that there's no need to announce a legal rule if the legal rule you choose is not actually outcome determinative in the case you are deciding. There is zero sensible account of an official duties test that would encompass the stuff alleged in special counsel Jack Smith's indictment against Donald Trump. There is zero sensible understanding of a clear statement rule under which presidents can't be, you know, criminally prosecuted for some set of official conduct that would apply to the circumstances of January 6th. None of that involves core presidential powers. There are no constitutional issues with telling a president you got to leave office if you lose an election. Like, and yet they are insisting like, oh no, we need to pronounce on everything in this case in which it's not actually necessary.
So did you guys hear 5 votes for some of this stuff? Because like, as I was listening to the argument and my heart was beating faster about all the things you're describing, I kept being like, well, is this just Justice Alito? And some of the wildest things were Justice Alito. But then, as you've mentioned, the things that Kavanaugh said seemed very much along the line of sending the case back for further proceedings, calling into doubt the conspiracy charge at bottom. And then I started listening for Roberts, and I couldn't actually tell where Roberts was. What did you guys think about that?
And let me follow up on exactly that point, because I think we had all thought this is a very solid, comprehensive D.C. Circuit opinion, bipartisan. They cover all the waterfront. And Roberts, it was clear, hated it, thought it was a piece of trash.
Tautology, I believe, is the word you're looking for, Harry.
Right. I don't even quite understand But yeah, he seemed to think that the reasoning of the D.C. Circuit opinion was as follows. He has been indicted, therefore he can be prosecuted criminally. That was actually, and that's, I mean, not even a caricature of the opinion. Are we getting to five and for what? And I wanted to say one thing to Mark, which is I got sick to my stomach when they started talking official acts because they were talking motive too. But back to, let me just add to Emily's point. What is Robert's beef with the D.C. Circuit opinion? And I mean, it seems to me he's certainly going to reverse in some fashion.
So first, I think there are four votes for the very, very, very bad theory slash outcome slash doctrine slash grand constitutional principle that forever applies herein. I mean, I think Thomas Shirley, who thinks January 6th was just a tourist visit gone wrong. I mean, his wife was at the Ellipse during the Stop the Steal speech. I don't think anyone seriously thinks that Clarence Thomas, who we should just pause to say, like, obviously should not have been sitting on this case, like, obviously should have recused, but now we just accept it as a fact that he doesn't. Thomas is surely in the bag. And I think Kavanaugh was just as bad as Alito, which he increasingly is these days, which is like a footnote that extremely worries me. I think that Kavanaugh is just right there with Alito, saying at a minimum that no federal criminal law can apply to the president unless there's a clear statement that it does. And there's like a tiny handful of statutes that do. Gorsuch found one and he pretended it was the bribery statute, but it's not. It's a statute involving bribery in a federal building.
Which they pointed out an argument, right? Like that did come out. It was there on the table. I was like, wait a second.
It was like a bag of money in the White House. Yep. That's the only thing. And I think that Gorsuch too was right there being like, and you know, he was kind of weaving in the stuff he does in other criminal law cases where I kind of like it, like, oh, it's such a vague law. You know, how do we know who this applies to? I mean, I'll give him credit to applying that for laws like the Armed Career Criminal Act and other sentencing laws. But here it's like, these are not vague laws, Neil. I mean, I know he tried to pretend they were in the Fisher case argued a week before. Either way, I think four votes for the bad side.
And the bad side equals what? What proposition is there four votes for?
Frankly, the way I've been summarizing it is that this indictment is unconstitutional. I mean, I just sort of think that that's like the basic summary.
Because of the clear statement problem or for another reason?
Because of a clear statement problem, because of some kind of secret executive immunity we don't know about, because the official acts are too intertwined with the private acts, because it's a vindictive prosecution, Alito seems to think. Either way.
For some secret reasons that maybe they'll tell us, maybe they won't, but yeah.
Right, right.
Oh, and this is all going to continue, says Alito, as if there's nothing extraordinary about the conduct here. What's extraordinary is just that the next administration is prosecuting the former president. But yeah, go ahead.
So I walked out having been in the courtroom thinking Roberts is also in the bag. After re-listening and rereading, I'm not sure, and I think you're absolutely right. He hated the D.C. Circuit opinion. He wants to, at a minimum, vacate the D.C. Circuit opinion. He does not want that on the books as a precedential opinion. I can't extrapolate much further than that. I don't know where he will go from there. I'm very curious to hear what Lee and Emily think, and you too, Harry, but I feel like he is very much up in the air, perhaps gettable if Barrett and the three liberals like try to work out some compromise that's not really going to make any sense and breaks all of our brains. But I don't think he's ready to jump off into the abyss quite yet.
Yeah, well, I think that too. And I'm just going to add one point, one-legged stool. That seemed to be his saying, you can't do the thing that so many commentators out there seem to be seizing onto, which is to just take off out the official acts, whatever that means. But we'll get to that in a moment.
Well, yeah, maybe this is a similar question. So I had this idea before the argument that there were kind of two ways into this case. There's no absolute immunity for official acts. Like that blanket idea has to be wrong. That's the D.C. Circuit. And then there is much of what Trump did was not official acts. So let's decide what was unofficial and then let's go in that direction. If you set aside the idea, the prayer of Trump being tried before the election, you just sort of forget about that. And then you move to, okay, what could at least five votes be for this case continuing? Then it seemed to me, I started to try to pay attention to this distinction that Dreeben kept making between office seekers and office holders, which seemed correct, at least to me, right? Like, what are the things Trump did because he was the president? What are the things he did because he was the candidate? And he was trying to hold on to this idea that he'd won. And you could put a lot of things in the candidate office seeker basket. And so if you let go of a trial in the foreseeable future, is the best case scenario that they send it back, that a lot of it turns out to be, in their view, unofficial acts, and then you start over again with that indictment? And eventually, if Trump is not elected in November and doesn't control the Justice Department, then he does go to trial. And that's like maybe okay for the future of American law? Or no, I'm missing an important thing that makes that still terrible.
So I think that that is a possibility for how this case could proceed, which is there are five votes. I totally agree with Mark. Roberts is not affirming the D.C. Circuit opinion. He's vacating it. And I think the best case scenario is it is a vacatur with the three Democratic appointees and Justice Barrett that says Trump's lawyer conceded all of this is private conduct. What remains to be decided is with respect to these remaining allegations in the indictment, whether they fall within the scope of the president's official duties, and if so, whether they can nonetheless be introduced at trial and under what conditions, i.e. with what kind of limiting instructions to be used for some purposes, but not as the basis of criminal liability. But then there's also a possibility, Emily, you were asking, like, well, could a trial proceed in the event that Trump is not reelected and, you know, there's another indictment and the trial is allowed to unfold? But then they are going to reserve judgment on whether there are constitutional questions with applying these criminal statutes that do not specify they apply to the president specifically, to the president in general. Again, like, I don't think they are necessarily going to say that now. And again, like, it's hard for me to get a read on the chief and Barrett on those issues based on this argument in this case. I hope they wouldn't say there are constitutional problems applying these statutes that don't specifically mention the president to these particular facts, again, which do not remotely concern core Article II powers or president's official duties. But my guess is the best hope is an opinion that vacates, directs some additional immunity determination, says nothing about the clear statement rules, and then the possibility of the court overturning the convictions later remains.
Can I add one footnote there, too? This is a point that Joyce Vance made that I think is really smart and like a little sliver of hope. Whether or not there's ominous language about the broader constitutionality of applying these laws to the president, it gives Judge Chutkan an opportunity to essentially hold something like a mini trial in the form of a novel evidentiary hearing over what's private and what's official. That's what Joyce said. You know, I think there's always a way for the DC Circuit and the Supreme Court not to permit that. And Harry, you're shaking your head. But I like the idea or the fantasy of this getting sent back down to Judge Chutkan, her being told you have to sort out, you have to extract what's official and make sure that eventually you can identify it and that the jury is not imposing liability on the basis of the official acts. And that becomes its own kind of hearing where like more evidence is introduced, because it's going to be made up from whole cloth. Nothing like this has ever happened before, right? She's just going to have to craft this new thing that the Supreme Court is going to force her to make up if it takes this route. And if she so chooses, I think there's a possibility she could try to make that more of a sort of like pre-trial show than not. But Harry, you're shaking your head. Tell me why that's not true.
Well, yeah, look, I think it's going to be made up from whole cloth, but I don't understand the test they would propound that would make it turn on factual determinations by a trial court. And on the contrary, the thing, in fact, I get off the train well before you guys, because the problem with the official versus non-official act distinction that everyone seemed happy with, and I actually heard it's not just Sauer, but I think Dreeben conceded that the DOJ stuff was official, is they seem to want to evaluate that. This is part of what I'm saying about the implausibility of some kind of factual hearing, without any kind of consideration of motive, which is the soul of the criminal law. Kagan asks, what about a president orders the military to stage a coup, or the famous SEAL 6 hypo? I think an opinion that actually strips the consideration of immunity from any subjective question of what was in the president's mind is disastrous.
Terrifying.
But I also think if that's where they're going, it doesn't leave room for what's Chutkan supposed, what is the fact that they're leaving open to decide? So, is there a way that they try to draw this distinction between, because what they really seem to be talking about of official versus unofficial is like broad area in which a president is operating. It's the military, ergo. And I don't know if even Roberts was there. Wasn't it Roberts who asked the question, what about appointment of an ambassador, but that's a bribe? To me, the official, unofficial act seems going headlong into this non-motive test because of some crazy misplaced worries about separation of powers and, you know, actually looking at the president's mindset. And I think that's like a disaster.
But is that so alarming from the point of view of presidential power and autocracy and like looming?
Yeah.
But is it so alarming that actually yeah. we have to be wrong? Like, there's just this part of yeah. me that I just am really resisting that there could possibly be five votes, even three votes for a theory of American law in which the president is truly above the law, except if Congress makes a clear statement and then courts decide that these were unofficial acts, like, but without looking into motive. Like, how can we live in a country in which if you do a coup and you're the president, I just can't square it. And I know you're going to all think this is naive of me, but like, what about original intent? I mean, come on, there are like 8 million statements from the framers about right. how important it
was. Kagan was all over that as well.
So I just, there's this part of me that's like, it can't land here. It's too radical. Am I right. just like being dumb?
Or the alternative, I think, is some like four standard kind of balancing factors. Like, and then what the hell do you do with that? It, you know, it's like really a serious principle. To violate the criminal law, it means to have an evil motive in the exercise of your official powers. Other things, you know, going out and shooting someone on Fifth Avenue is such a trivial application of what we're worried about. All right. Is a distinction between official and unofficial acts tied in their minds necessarily to stripping out consideration of motive?
I don't think that the naughty four even believe that motive is a legitimate inquiry. I mean, you had Justice Gorsuch saying like, well, every first term president wants a second term and everything that he does has the motive of winning a second term. So is that an improper motive? Like, how can I see the difference between that and trying to stage a coup? Well, first of all, I have a longstanding belief that Kavanaugh has just fundamentally does not understand much of criminal law. But here, I also think that he seemed to say that inquiring about motive could potentially be unconstitutional. He kept linking this to like executive privilege and that like any kind of oversight of the president would be sort of unacceptable to him. And so I don't think whatever test they devise turns on motive. But then again, if this doesn't turn out apocalyptic, if this turns out as some kind of like Barrett and Roberts doing something with the liberals that's sort of a compromise, I don't think those other four have any say over it. And so I am very much confused and uncertain about whether and how motive enters the calculation.
All right. Barrett and Roberts cobble some together with the liberals, but it doesn't involve motive. Any thoughts that isn't? Because there is this pretty big stream of commentary who are kind of saying similar things that like, oh, no, it's all pretty good. The five somehow get together. You cleave off non-official, whatever that means. And by the way, as you just pointed out, there's Fisher out there. And if the court overall thinks 371, the first count takes the Kavanaugh that Alito seconded right away. It's all too vague. You're left with the 241 count of the, you know, abridgment of the right to have one's vote counted.
Which we thought was the weakest when the indictment came out.
Legal theory-wise, it is the weakest, right? You're Jack Smith now. How are you planning to salvage things? How are you going to recalibrate and reconfigure the indictment in anticipation of whatever the hell the court might be doing? You know, Dreeben was there. He got some pretty harsh criticism, actually, for given his very high deserved reputation. But what are they now thinking? Like, in what form does this case survive?
I'm not going to pretend to know more about what Jack Smith should do than whatever Jack Smith and his team are preparing to do. But I guess two things kind of come to mind. One is, you know, Mark noted the Fisher argument just to kind of make clear what that is in reference to. Fisher was a case involving another participant in January 6, where the challenge is that one of the federal laws that some January 6 participants have been convicted under, which is one of two of the charges against Donald Trump, that law actually does not prohibit interfering with the kind of proceeding of January 6, that is like the counting of electoral votes, and instead just prohibits interfering with investigations that involve the collection of evidence or records. And so one possibility that was floated during the Fisher argument is, well, maybe the government could argue that actually 1512C2 does apply because of the relevance of the electoral certificates themselves. And because Donald Trump is alleged to have been involved in putting together a fake slate of electors, maybe that is a way to salvage the 1512C2 charges.
At least Barrett served that up. Yeah,
exactly. Against Trump in particular. So that's definitely one avenue to allow the case to proceed on several of the charges that are already in there. Another thing is, right, to start having difficult conversations about like which parts of the indictment are necessary to telling the story. You know, two of the things that they kind of picked out are the conversations with the Department of Justice. I don't see how it is possible to omit that at all, because of course you have DOJ lawyers telling Donald Trump there's no fraud here, the results are legitimate. And without that, right, it's harder to make the case, given some of the questions of motive and intent and whatnot. But some of the other specific conversations were, you know, the remarks by Donald Trump about possibly firing someone so that he could have someone else at the Department of Justice do his bidding. Maybe that part of the story goes away. So those are kind of two things that are probably on the table right now.
I mean, what's so problematic about this, thinking through, Leah, what you're saying is that it would take the things Trump did as a candidate, an office seeker, but then eliminate the ways in which he was abusing his power.
Exactly.
Which is the whole story of the case.
Michael Dreeben said, in our view, it is worse that he was using the office of the presidency and abusing it than that he was just doing something privately.
Yes.
And of course, that's completely correct.
This is why I hate the official, non-official distinction.
Right. I mean, yes. So then I think the only way I can salvage that in my own head is to think, okay, however this works with the pinning the facts to the charges, you could imagine an indictment in which the charges are about the candidate, the office seeking, but you're still allowed to bring in the evidence of your abuse of office as the president to further those schemes, conspiracies, criminal acts, whatever you want to call them.
I mean, this is a good point, and I thought this is one that if it comes up, the five really could say that, you know, it was a latent, there are just a few questions about it, but can you, even if it doesn't go to immunity, can you nevertheless introduce it in an evidentiary way so at least the jury hears about it? There could be five votes for that.
Well, and then you have a jury instruction telling the jury, okay, you've heard this as, you know, for evidence, but you can't consider it in deciding whether to impose criminal liability, which happens all the time in criminal
yes.
courts around the country. Juries get those instructions. But I got the sense from like Alito that he was just sort of sniffing at the idea, the comic notion that a jury could ever take that instruction
yes.
to disregard. Like
eclipses happen sometimes too. Yes. Right.
The many ways.
We just have to pause on the irony of listening to Alito and other conservatives act as if all the checks in the criminal justice system, every single one of them, are all just worthless. Like, oh, you can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich, so forget about that. And like, oh, appeals take forever. I mean, these are the people who are the strictest usually about applying criminal law. And it was, you know, Dreeben and then sometimes the three Democratic appointed justices or Barrett, who would sometimes sort of stick up for like American law and order. Like, gee, most attorneys general, almost all of them, have acted in good faith. And if they give advice to the president one way or the other, yes, we could consider that in terms of his criminal intent. There was just something so Alice through the looking glass about this conceptual part, right?
Well, more than, yeah, he's a deeply cynical and pessimistic guy, because what he was really saying, this goes to your constitutional policy making in Kavanaugh, he was basically saying, we're now in a place in this country where this isn't going to stop. There's nothing particularly special or distinctive about Trump. He's just sort of a sign of the times, and therefore we have to deal with it. I have a strange question that just occurred to me, and Lee, I hope you don't mind. So, I mean, you and Melissa and Kate are really trenchant observers of the scene. As we tape, we haven't heard what you had to say, but I'm really struck by the diversity, or you could even say confusion, of expert opinion about what they were saying and where they're going. What was your guys' takeaway about the case in your discussion?
I mean, I think it's kind of what we have all arrived at. There is no possibility of a straight up affirmance. The most likely and best case scenario is a vacatur with the three Democratic appointees, the chief and Barrett, on a very narrow immunity ground and leaving all the questions for the other day. The other four Republican appointees do not seem to be in play at all. I think it is possible that Barrett is open to being reasonable here. I say that because she has actually voted with the Democratic appointees in some shadow docket matters that have actually been outcome determinative in a way that, you know, was not yet true when we had that conversation about Dobbs. But the other side of the coin, or I guess, you know, other consideration, is that there have been oral arguments where she has sounded reasonable before. So I'm thinking back to the Texas SBA case, for example. After that oral argument, it sounded like she understood the real problems with Texas's bounty hunter law and then ended up voting with her Republican colleagues anyways. And so I have yet to see her, frankly, do something in an argued case that is principled and materially different than her male Republican colleagues. And so I am more than a little nervous that it seems like it is going to come down to her and the chief.
Can I just add one observation from being on the scene, sort of vibes-based observation? It seemed like the five male justices were mad at Dreeben for arguing this case. It felt like there was a lot of bristling hostility toward Dreeben for being up there at the lectern arguing for Jack Smith's team. I struggle to sort of like give concrete examples. I mean, you can sort of hear it, I think, in the audio.
Yes.
But also in the body language, like there was a like real just ongoing bristling at everything he said. And there were points when he couldn't even get a word out. And the chief's exchange with him about the D.C. Circuit opinion, he seemed like, how dare you defend the D.C. Circuit opinion? And he seized upon the phrase, the tautological word that Dreeben used, and then whipped it out against him and just like lashed him with it over and over again. And maybe said the chief aside, because I think there was something weird going on with him. I don't know if he forgot his coffee, whatever. But I felt like for the four naughty boys, as I've called them, this was of a piece with their broader hostility toward what some would call the deep state in this case. When people like Alito are criticizing these prosecutors and winking like, we all know they can indict a ham sandwich and we all know you can't really. We both worked in the Justice Department, Alito said to Dreeben. We know what really goes on there. It seemed like they were sort of buying into this Fox News narrative that like these guys are all just deep state plants out to get Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And I felt like they were almost sort of suggesting like, and Dreeben, you've joined them. I mean, Dreeben has built up so much, I had thought, goodwill at this court, arguing throughout how many administrations, how many sides of how many cases, the ultimate nonpartisan civil servant. And they treated him like he was the ugly face of the deep state that they loathe. And that to me, it felt gross. And I walked out of there needing to take a shower, not just because of my TV makeup, but because it was really like, you should not have mistreated this like very honorable man this way.
It did feel like, you know, they were so all over him, and that Kagan had to basically, you know, the way they're working now, sort of at the end of the line, just give him some room to make his basic points. He hadn't even been able to get his argument out.
The scenario we're painting, or some of the possibilities, are so alarming that I just feel like maybe they were had to be working out some of their issues in oral argument, and like it won't be so bad when we read it. And one of the reasons I keep thinking that was something that Justice Jackson articulated so well, which is that even though until now we have not had a former president under criminal indictment, every single president lived with that possibility. That constraint was there in the back of his mind, right? Because nobody had taken it off the table. And she was really clear about the difference it would make if you took it off the table, if they really came to this extreme conclusion that unless Congress makes a clear statement, the president cannot be prosecuted. That is a really different country that we would be living in.
And I just can't
imagine. I'm going to continue to hold hope in my heart that that is unimaginable. It's not conservative. There's nothing conservative about that idea.
Well, yes, although every time they've applied it, it has been in the service of, you know, Atascadero. And when we need a clear statement, it's always because, it, you know, as best I can think of, the 11th Amendment being the best example because of conservative concerns.
I just mean the small C conservatism is about stability. That's it.
And Emily, that's the whole shock of comparing this with the Anderson case, right? The Trump ballot removal case. And the Trump ballot removal case, they say, well, we need stability. We need democracy. So we have to step in and make sure that like a single rogue state doesn't, you know, try to decide an election for the whole country because we are the guardians of a stable democracy. And here it's like the exact opposite. It's like basically sort of screw democracy. Like we don't even think that like presidential elections should necessarily matter. Again, I don't want to go too far down that dark path because I think maybe they were blowing off some steam. I'll choose to believe that. But if you compare the two decisions side by side, it's very hard to square any kind of consistent principles between the majority and them.
Well, there is a consistent principle, which is, you know, like Republicans are entitled to get to do what they want with political power, right? Like that is what democracy means, but Democrats don't. Because of course, like in the Colorado disqualification case, you have a Colorado state law, right, that Colorado voters, right, have been okay with that the Colorado Supreme Court enforced. And that was not good democracy. Instead, good democracy was allowing Donald Trump to run for president. Here, right, we have a special counsel who was appointed by, right, an attorney general selected by a president who won the popular vote, enforcing laws that Congress has passed. That is bad democracy. Good democracy is giving Donald Trump immunity, especially before the election, so that he can run for president.
And if he wins, then he can eliminate this entire prosecution.
Yeah.
Because we're going to make sure this trial doesn't happen before November.
I want to make one prefatory point, which is one day we will know, but I'd really like to know what was going on in those 13 days when people were thinking there maybe someone was preparing a dissent from denial and they were really fighting over what I now think was mirrored in the actual argument. There were some bringing, like Alito and Gorsuch, bringing great concerns to the table of other cases. But why 13 days? And did they somehow bring somebody along? But on timing, isn't it a foregone conclusion that there's going to be multiple opinions here and a kind of a bitterness? And this has got to be the end of June or this got to be the end of the term, right? And that being the case, even the best case scenario without this sort of hearing, there's still, what was it, you know, 90 days or something of process when we froze things in December. You can't abridge that. And so we're talking with no remand. A scenario of end of September, whatever. So I don't quite understand the sense of how somehow this could all work out even in like August, which is the date that's being bandied about. All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thanks, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we break out the three types of vodka to see if there's a clear difference. Vodka is typically a colorless, flavorless spirit, served neat and freezer chilled. Simple, right? But long before the shot glasses are topped off and toasts are shouted, there's a fermenting process. For vodka, that process involves distilling an organic base like barley, rye, wheat, even potatoes or corn to make one of three types of vodka: plain, flavored, and infused. Rye can add a heavier texture and spice. Barley may be a little lighter and mild, while potatoes can add a creamy mouthfeel. Unflavored is the simplest and most traditional form of vodka, with a mixture of 40% ethanol and 60% water. Flavored vodka has recently become extremely popular, adding flavors that range from fruit to dessert-inspired options, like chocolate. A charcoal-filtered vodka provides a smoother taste, perfect for creating a chocolate martini that tastes as great as it sounds. Lastly, there's infused vodka, also known as botanical vodka, where the distillers infuse the vodka by adding ingredients like herbs, flowers, spices, and fruit, which are steamed into the spirit during the distillation process. It's an excellent choice to dial your drink in any flavor direction you want. The best part of them all is that you don't have to travel the world to find the greatest vodkas. Your local Total Wine & More has a large selection of every type and flavor, so all you have to do is clear out a little extra room in your freezer. So find what you love and love what you find, only at Total Wine & More. Cheers!
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate. All right, there are people who are really good, really know the court well, etc., who are seeing, you know, silver linings. I see it as a fucking disaster, starting with the notion of even trying to carve out official from unofficial acts. Are we being alarmist or are they being Panglossian? And it was such a big case, and I'm really struck by people's sort of conflicting views about where the court was, even based on that 3 hours of argument.
Can you say which arguments you're talking about?
Yeah, so there's this basic notion that the five could somehow endorse a principle that says this chunk is okay, this chunk isn't. So just get rid of this chunk and now go and try this right away. Now, for starters, and again, this is something that I've been more focused on, and maybe I'm missing something, but for starters, the only thing I've heard to define the chunk is official versus unofficial. And, you know, Kagan, you know, her question earlier, so you're saying that somebody can order the military to perform a coup. That's where I think the thrust of this is. So, I think that's a terrible line, but that's the notion that the five basically say, here's a part, you know, Sauer conceded, here's a part of the case that can go forward. So it goes forward sort of lickety-split, and, you know, there's actually a reckoning and accountability in relative short order and, you know, something like that.
I just think that's a fantasy world, because I think in a world in which you are imagining an opinion that directs the lower courts to separate out some official from non-official stuff, that is going to make it a task for special counsel to figure out, how do I prove motive in a world in which I am not allowed potentially some of the evidence about Donald Trump's interactions with the Department of Justice, during which he is repeatedly told this is a valid election, you lost, right? Because like that is relevant to all of the charges. And so I just think like, sure, right, maybe they can all figure this out in like 24 hours and figure out how to do like a perfect trial, right, in the 90 days that Judge Chutkan was envisioning even before this entire mess arose. But I just think that is a really tall task, and also ignores how Trump's lawyers have at every turn attempted to elongate the proceedings, add additional delay. And so I just don't see that unfolding that neatly.
And there's going to be stuff they can use, whatever it is. My glumness, in a word, is if they start with official versus unofficial and no motive, it feels terrible to me. If they do anything else, it feels deeply confused and time-consuming and amorphous.
Well, I'm just playing devil's advocate. I'm just going to spitball this. How about if they took all the things that Sauer conceded were private acts, and that's the basis for the trial, and then all the "I was president, I ordered the Justice Department" stuff comes in as evidence about criminal intent. So again, like the ways in which you abused your office in order to stay in office after you lost, it's still part of the case.
But like, let's just spin this out. Judge Chutkan said 90 days, right, without this possibility. Figuring out how exactly precisely to instruct the jury is an additional layer of briefing and arguments and whatnot that is just going to push this until, I think, after the election, unless, again, something very different happens.
I'm only talking about eventual outcome, not timing.
Okay, yeah.
But that's the thing. Here's why I'm so, and I'm not, I don't normally find myself in this position, but so like, glum and enraged, because timing is screwed. And substance, even in what we're positing here, that there's some pieces to kind of pick up what they've done to immunity law, what they've done to the proposition that the president is not a king, is really, I think, demolishing.
So let's just like forget the timing problem for a minute. I know I also find that difficult to give up. But in terms of thinking about, let's think of this as the case for the ages. Is there an outcome you can imagine five of them getting to that does not do damage to American law and immunity?
or big damage. Yes, but it has to be taking account of motive in considering what, I mean, we're calling it now official versus unofficial as if it's some kind of solution to the puzzle and just the key that opens it up. But the only suggestion they seem to have is areas shorn of motive. So yes, something like that. But that's very much where we are. That's sort of Nixon versus Fitzgerald anyway. Outer perimeter of official duties. Like he's acting like, not at all like a president. But they seem to be really going toward a kind of categorical distinction that strips away mens rea. And so that I find very worrisome. Like, how are they going to answer Kagan's question, I guess, is a shorthand way to put it. There is a sort of Panglossian scenario where what does he do? He retakes a grand jury and charges insurrection that they shied away from, but that's a big roll of the dice, but that solves the other problem.
Then he does that in October, right before the election.
Right. Yeah, I know, it's all...
I don't think that Jack Smith is going to now come in and charge insurrection, but I You're just... Right. So if he did, the Anderson majority suggested, but did not say outright, that a president who is convicted of insurrection under 2383 could be disqualified from office.
I thought they said it outright.
Rick Hassan and I are on team. They suggest it, but do not declare it with total certitude. Either way,
all right.
Let's just go with they say it, they said it outright. Okay, how in the world could that ever be proved against a sitting president like Trump if the court enforces this incredibly strict divide between official and unofficial acts, and the jury only gets to hear about and consider unofficial acts? I mean, presumably, enforcing the insurrection statute against a sitting president would go to things like directing the military to do X, Y, and Z, meddling with the Justice Department to ignore or enforce whatever law or bogus fraud.
You're at the nub of why I'm like way on the left or right or whatever it is. Any other thing you say, if you insert the no motive, et cetera, the consequences seem extreme to me. And yet, you know, they're not... I'm genuinely puzzled and thinking and hoping that I'm like being unduly glum.
That's not what they'll actually say. Not that there wasn't reason for concern about it from argument, but that we will not land there because it's just too unthinkable. I'm sticking with that.
Okay, so that's right. I think there's a possibility where we land somewhere else. Forget about 2024, but the somewhere else is like a deeply muddled four standard, you know, instead of the clean thing that is the soul of the DC Circuit opinion that he finds so offensive, which is the criminal law applies to the president in full force. Why is that crazy?
Well, also, like, can I just say the holding of the DC Circuit is criminal law applies to the president full force. He is not immune. They didn't purport to resolve these other questions that the Supreme right. Court justices are now preoccupied with, which is yes. whether, assuming there is a conviction, right, the conviction can be challenged as unconstitutional because the statute under which you were convicted doesn't apply to you, right, or can't constitutionally be applied to you. And so it's only supposed to be this narrow immunity question. And that was extremely irksome. And I just want to say one more thing, which is one of the last times the court heard a major executive power case, right? United States versus Nixon, the court didn't announce some grand legal standard about like when
purposely.
Presidents, right, purposefully. They're just like
judicial modesty.
Here's some considerations, right? Obviously, this is fine. And the idea that that is just like not on the table here is just ridiculous.
Not acting like a court.
Right.
This is what I meant by early on when you were there. It's like, wow, holy you know, judicial modesty, Roberts, look where they are going. Well, let's see. I'll just say, listeners, there are definitely podcasts out there that you can end with a rosier view, but it ain't this one. So I don't know. I feel this is a grim talking feds. Anybody, any of the three of you want to have some final thought?
Taylor Swift's Eras Tour resumes shortly.
Leah's wearing her Stevie sweatshirt. That's good.
That double album was pretty spotty, didn't you think? And
all right, no, Harry,
that's not what I think at
There's
all,
There's a lot
Harry.
Of really good stuff on it, Harry.
Whatever the case, we're trying to end on an up note. Just go with the up note.
It's dense. Okay.
She's a content queen. That's all I'll say.
Hey, I spent a week watching, and will spend more, watching Donald Trump brought to heel absolutely by a judge who is more than his match, although he doesn't have that many legal tools, and a pretty good week of trial from the DA here. That's it. Yeah, that's our, instead of talking five, say something, good in any topic whatsoever.
Can we talk about Beyonce's new album? I like Beyonce's new album. How about that?
Texas Hold'em and the Blackbird cover. Beautiful.
So with you.
I like Bodyguard.
That's very
Bodyguard
catchy.
Is my fave.
Carriages?
Yeah.
16 Carriages was written for first daughters. Yes.
Yaya is also a banger, top to bottom.
I saw Hiromi. She's a jazz pianist and played like a 15-minute version of Blackbird that also was mesmerizing. It's a beautiful world.
Well, I guess let me just tell listeners what I always tell people who text me that they're depressed about the Supreme Court. I always say the Supreme Court is already ruining the country. You shouldn't let it ruin your weekend as well. And I think that's good advice to everyone who's listening to Talking Feds.
I feel like we just failed that test, Mark.
We are out of time. Thank you so much to Emily, Leah, and Mark. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts, and please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we are posting full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at TalkingFedsPod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is still a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. You can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. And you can still also email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine, associate producer Meredith McCabe, sound engineering by Matt McCardle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Dawn Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers, and production assistance by Akshaj Turbailu. Our music is, as ever, by the amazing Philip Glass. Talking Feds is a production of Delito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.